From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gustina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, budget officials say they have to revise their spending plan to rein in spending proposals. Our political observer Alan Shartok shares his thoughts on GOP Chair Ed Cox blaming Governor Cuomo for the state having the highest taxes in the nation. And a judge in White Plains federal court denies a request to allow unvaccinated children to return to a school in Rockland County. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. With the state budget due April 1st, Governor Andrew Cuomo's top budget officials say they have to revise their spending proposal now that President Donald Trump has released a budget plan that they say could devastate New York's healthcare system. And they are pressuring the legislature to rein in their spending proposals as well. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
Cuomo's budget director, Robert Mujica, in a briefing with reporters, says his staff stayed up all night crunching the numbers from the president's budget proposal. They conclude that if it's approved in Congress, the spending plan would cut federal health care funding for New York by 20%, or $11.5 billion over the next 10 years. Because of that, Mujica says the governor has decided to restore around $500 million in cuts he made to the state's Medicaid and other health care programs for hospitals and nursing homes.
If any of these cuts take effect, we have to now relook at our entire budget, because we have to now work to shore up the hospitals and nursing homes and the healthcare side of the budget.
Mujica says his staff is combing through the spending plan to identify other areas for reductions.
We are going to have to go back into the budget and look at how we can reprioritize spending, cut spending in other areas, to restore those cuts, because now, in light of this, that is the number one priority, and it should be for the legislature as well.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Would the chairwoman yield, please?
The announcement comes as both houses of the legislature are approving their own budget plans in preparation for negotiations on a final budget. The legislative budgets also restored the $500 million in health care cuts. The Democratic-led Senate and Assembly plans also include around $600 million more dollars for school aid than the governor put into his spending plan, as well as other increases, including more aid for college students and more funding for carrying out the census in 2020, among other things. The governor's chief of staff, Melissa DeRosa, who was also attending the briefing, says this year, though, with warnings of a recession on the horizon, the legislature's proposals are not realistic and could raise spending by as much as $2.5 billion.
We need to move the conversation from fantasy land to reality.
David Friedfeld with the watchdog group Citizens Budget Commission says there is reason to be concerned over the president's proposed cuts, but he says the likelihood of Congress actually approving all of the changes is pretty minimal.
They're certainly not totally wrong on the fact that the state should be concerned about what's going to happen in the state's economy and what impact that will have on the state's revenues.
The Senate and Assembly budgets are often viewed as wish lists for members eager to claim credit for projects popular with their constituents. But Friedfeld says the proposals are a serious indication of the legislature's priorities.
Frequently, this is a blueprint for what they're going to be pushing for, and while some of those, listed priorities may fall off the table, certainly spending increases on education. And in the past, we've seen that the final adopted budget is somewhere in between what the governor proposed and what the legislature passed in their one-house budgets.
He says in past years, the governor has given in and agreed to compromise to include more spending in the final budget. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Quite a passionate response to primarily Governor Cuomo, claiming that Cuomo is a tax raiser since the beginning of his gubernatorial term, and still New York remains number one on the top tax state list.
Look, Ed Cox came out punching like a boxer. He's had a tough time. Obviously, they did very badly in the elections. The New York congressional delegation changed. The state Senate went to the Democrats, but he is not compromising when it comes to Cuomo. He has been really, really aggressive about that. And I suppose that's what his job is. He's the leader of the other team.
Well, Alan, they're pulling the belt tight on the budget and calling for a pullback on spending.
Well, it has always fallen to the role of the governor and the controller, the state controller, to underestimate how much revenue is coming in, or to lowball it at very least. The reason for that, David, is that, they don't want to be caught with their economic pants down. If, in fact, it turns out that revenue is coming in slower, which it already is. And that is what the governor has to do, because he is also defending New York as a leading tax state. I live in Massachusetts, sometimes called Taxachusetts, but it doesn't compare with New York. The question is whether we are spending money and not getting results for that money. In my conversation this week on our Capital Connection program with Ed Cox, that's exactly the case that he's making. We're spending the money on education, but we're not getting results. That is something we have heard from Republicans for an awful long time. I hope that the answer that occurs to them isn't that we shouldn't be spending the money on education. I do think our insistence on excellence and that things get better is pretty good. You know, the governor has decided to make an example, David, in my conversation with him this week, out of the people who are running the school districts and saying that superintendents are making $300,000. Now, that is a lot of money. And yet, people who run hospitals are making millions. People who are running universities, presidents of university, are making millions. When a Long Island school district pays that kind of money, it's because they're in a competitive market and they want the best for their kids. I think, however, I do think that the governor, by going after the $300,000 salary of a school superintendent, really finds a place in most people's minds because they think it's a lot of money.
Well, the governor having a problem with the head of the GOP, Ed Cox, is understandable, but he's also in conflict with the state Senate. And the Senate Majority Leader, Andrea Stewart Cousins, a fellow Democrat, apparently has spoken with Governor Andrew Cuomo about his, quote, disparagement of the Senate Democrats. He said to you in conversations that they're new to governing in that chamber.
Yes, David, he is in a war with the Senate Democrats. Here's the way I see it. And by the way, with the Assembly also, because Carl Hastie and Andrea Stewart Cousins seem to be doing a team effort here where the governor is concerned. And they've both been tough on the governor, so there's a real sort of fight going on. The way that it worked was the Republicans were in control for all of these years. And no matter what he says, the governor could pretty well get what he wanted out of the Republicans, because if they didn't go along, he was going to count them out. And he did, but only when there was great pressure on him. Now, he finds himself in a position of having this unified Assembly and Senate out there. And we can only say in some cases, wonderful cases, they have made some very progressive choices. In others, they are really going to fight. And the amount of money in the budget is one example of that, because inevitably the legislature wants to give more money to their constituents. And I think the governor misses the old Republican Senate, which he could blame for saying no to him. So this is almost a preemptive war, the way I see it. Now, let me just say that the Democrats in the Senate need to be able to get out there and make their message plain.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustinum. A district judge in White Plains federal court this week denied a request to allow unvaccinated children to return to a school in Rockland County. The lawsuit is moving forward during what the judge terms an, quote, unprecedented measles outbreak. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn was in court.
The ruling comes as part of a lawsuit filed by more than 20 parents against the Rockland County Health Department and its commissioner. The lawsuit challenges the breadth of an exclusion order barring their unvaccinated children from attending the Green Meadow Waldorf School in Chestnut Ridge, which bases its education on the teachings of Rudolf Steiner. Attorney Michael Sussman represents the parents and describes the judge's ruling.
The judge denied the request for a temporary restraining order. He indicated that he felt that there was discretion within public health authorities to act as they did.
Sussman had asked the court to overturn the county's exclusion order that has kept some 50 children out of the school since December.
In my view, the exclusion order is overbroad. There has been not a single case of measles reported. Anyone in the school, in that school community, in the broader community, which makes up the fellowship in Chestnut Ridge. I do not believe state law gives the authority to the public health commissioner of the county or the state to exclude children from school where there is no reported case of measles in the specific school.
Rockland County Attorney Thomas Humbach.
This is a necessary act. There's no joy in depriving somebody of a liberty that they've taken advantage of. But as I stated earlier, you know, the Supreme Court has held that the public health is the primary objective, is a primary objective of the government. And we have to stand strong for the protection of the babies and the infirm who would be affected by this disease.
To date, there are 146 confirmed cases of measles within Rockland County, the majority of which are in Hasidic communities. The county's exclusion order applies to two zip codes considered hotspots and keeps unvaccinated children from attending schools with vaccination rates below 95% in these areas. Humbach says this is the best way to act preventatively. He says Green Meadow's vaccination rate is less than 60%.
In this case, we are dealing with a matter that has not been directly decided, and that is the exclusion in a school that does not have a direct exposure. However, as I said, if you go to these schools or if a student from one of these schools does get exposed and brings it back, that's 24 new vectors for the disease.
Again, Sussman.
There's been no case that I know of which has sustained the blanket exclusion of children, as here, in schools beyond that affected by measles. The county doesn't cite any cases. I know of no case.
U.S. District Judge Vincent Bracetti said, quote, "It's a tough situation and I feel bad about it," end quote. He also said he is sympathetic and urged the county to search for a middle ground, saying he is not ordering Rockland to do something, but strongly encouraging it. Here's Humbach.
Well, the problem is the measles isn't going to take a middle ground. We've taken steps that have, we believe, lessened the impact of this disease on the community substantially. If there were no vaccinations, 325 people in Rockland County could be dead or disabled or maimed by this disease at a 1 in 1,000 rate. I'll discuss the matter with my client. At this point, I do not have any belief that we're going to change the regimen that we're taking to protect the public. And as sympathetic as the case may be, the community must be protected.
The lawsuit identifies parents by their initials, and parents who spoke to reporters Tuesday declined to give their names. One parent, choking back tears, has a 4-year-old preschooler who has not been to school in more than 3 months.
Preventing my child from being with his class, his teacher, his classroom, has had a significant social and psychological impact. He is confused, given his young age, about why he isn't allowed on his campus. He misses his friends and is being deprived of the unique educational setting that our school provides and the developmental growth that sustained peer and teacher relationships foster in the early childhood years.
She says the case is not about vaccinating versus not vaccinating. Rather, it's about protecting rights. Again, Humbach.
And with any luck, the measles outbreak will end before the case does.
Humbach says children may return to school if there is no confirmed measles case reported 21 days since the last case, which at this point was March 13th. The first confirmed cases appeared in October.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
In the 1970s, the U.S. Air Force began using a firefighting foam that contained the chemicals PFOS and PFOA, which have contaminated water supplies in communities across the Northeast. The Air Force is now using a May 2016 Lifetime Health Advisory Level, or LHA, set by the EPA to determine safe levels and is cleaning up sites above acceptable levels. A recent update indicates there are still a few homes affected near the former Plattsburgh Air Force Base. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley reports.
On February 15th, the U.S. Air Force Civil Engineer Center updated the cleanup status of perfluorinated compounds at its facilities. The Air Force PFOS-PFOA snapshot reports that 203 installations, including active, National Guard, and closed bases, require preliminary assessments, and of those, 189 are expected to require a site inspection to identify current levels of contamination. Drinking water mitigation response is occurring at 21 installations. Options include bottled water, filtration, or hooking homes up to municipal water supplies. The latest update finds that four residential wells on Kemp Lane, adjacent to the former Plattsburgh Air Force Base, are above the LHA. Three homes are being fitted with water filtration systems, and the fourth is receiving bottled water. It's not new information, according to Town of Plattsburgh Supervisor Michael Cashman.
The Air Force, the federal government, has fully acknowledged that the contamination falls on their shoulders. The payment to build out the infrastructure and or some other remedy, again, falls on their shoulders. We're more than willing to help out. Right now, the federal government is working with the homeowners to provide them, you know, bottled water, et cetera. And this has been going on for some time. The news broke, you know, fairly recently, but this has been going on for a while.
Significant industrial development has occurred on the former military facility. Plattsburgh North Country Chamber of Commerce President Gary Douglas says water contamination has not impacted development at Plattsburgh International Airport.
Economic development, new industrial development simply doesn't use that ground source for water for any purposes. And the Air Force has always been on the hook, will always be on the hook for everything known and anything potentially unknown that turns up in the future.
Douglas adds that following the closure of the base, concerns centered on other environmental contaminants and monitoring continues.
I know from my park days, you know, a lot of the attention focused on the so-called plume on the flight side, not on the side where these houses are, caused, as I recall, in an unknowing way in the 1950s and 1960s, that as part of firefighting training, they would dump jet fuel on the ground, set it afire, and then put it out. But that plume has test monitoring wells on it that the Air Force will have to monitor in perpetuity. It's way underground, not actually impacting anything as long as it remains stable. And development has continued on the surface above it. So even things that have been known have not actually stymied development at the airport.
In Newburgh, a backup water source has been required due to PFOS contamination from the Stewart Air National Guard facility. Construction on a state-funded system was complete, but not operating as of the February publication date. Unspecified non-drinking water mitigation was also listed at the Burlington Air National Guard facility in Vermont.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. In February, New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey introduced a Green New Deal resolution, a set of proposed economic stimulus programs to address climate change and racial and social economic inequalities. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas attended a Green New Deal forum at Albany's Public Library, where about 100 people attended, and filed this report.
The Green Party's Howie Hawkins is widely viewed as the first candidate for public office in the United States to promote a Green New Deal during his 2010 gubernatorial campaign in New York. At the forum, Hawkins painted an apocalyptic picture of the near future. He warned, based on the amount of carbon being released into the atmosphere, we have 6.5 years of carbon budget left before temperatures rise and Arctic ice melts.
At which point, we're basically cooked, literally. What this crisis means is mass extinctions and ecosystems collapse, the end of agriculture that can feed the population we have, widespread poverty, social conflict and wars for what's left. And that's by 2050. With ocean acidification and the destruction of phytoplankton, which provide 2/3 of the oxygen in the atmosphere, we're facing basically suffocating to death by the year 2100, according to some scientists.
Green Education and Legal Fund Chair Mark Dunlay says the new push in Washington closely mirrors the concept borrowed from the Greens in Europe circa 2007.
The proposal that's been advanced by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Markey has a lot of similarities. It talks about a very rapid emergency mobilization to convert our economy to 100% clean energy by 2030. It also makes the second demand of implementing FDR's last Economic Bill of Rights proposal, which is the idea of a guaranteed living wage job and universal health care and affordable housing.
Not everyone's on board. On Friday, the AFL-CIO, which represents 12.5 million workers and includes 55 labor unions, shot down the Green New Deal in a letter to lawmakers. Other critics say the plan would be too expensive to implement. Dave Pablo is a farmer and activist now living in Troy. He says people really need to understand how global warming will affect their everyday existence. He warns of a farm-to-table disconnect and thinks that the U.S. is not far away from having a breakdown in the food distribution system.
When you have climate changes like this and you have radical weather events, whether it's drought or sudden freezes or weather extremes like that, you can have systemic crop failure. People who wander into the supermarket and they buy the things that they eat and they don't really appreciate where they come from or how vulnerable they are, it just becomes an abstract issue. So we need to translate how this whole thing is going to impact every single person in this area on a day-to-day basis. And once that reality sinks in, then they may be able to translate it for their politicians a little bit better.
Dunlay points out that two New York Democrats, Congressman Paul Tonko and Antonio Delgado, have not been supportive of the Green New Deal.
The resolution that's been introduced in Congress on the Green New Deal actually has a lot of supporters in New York State. 13 members of the House from New York State are sponsors of that bill, as well as Senator Gillibrand. Unfortunately, Congressman Tonko and Congressman Delgado are missing on that list.
Tonko says he shares many of the principles outlined in the Green New Deal, while Delgado says he supports a Green New Deal that works for upstate New York. Delgado's office says, quote, there is not a one-size-fits-all solution. And Representative Delgado is committed to a plan that dramatically reduces our reliance on carbon while promoting the economic interests of upstate New York. Tonko's office says while he shares many of the Green New Deal's principles, quote, as chairman of the Subcommittee on Environment and Climate Change in the House, my task is to take big ideas like the ones laid out in the non-binding resolution and turn them into real policy tools, which support throughout our caucus that can help us make the transition to a cleaner, safer, and more sustainable economy. Advocates for the plan haven't ruled out protests outside the congressman's local offices. You can read their full responses at WAMC.org. Dunlay warns that not everything billed as part of the Green New Deal actually is.
A lot of people have begun to call everything they do that either has something to do with the climate or has something to do with economic rights a Green New Deal program. And I think what we see particularly from Governor Cuomo is that he uses the Green New Deal not to really embrace what we would call the program, but as a slogan to make the point that if we invest in renewable energy, we will create jobs. Now, that's a good point, and we support that. But in and of itself, that's not the Green New Deal.
Dave Lucas.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1911. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.